Hello and welcome to Earth Heart Network Radio, the land-to-mouth food farm and garden edition that comes your way every Tuesday, live from 1 to 2 p.m. Lisa Almaraz here, your host and producer. So glad to be spending this time with you each week. And later in the hour, we're usually joined by Patrick Battle for This Week in the Garden, where we take a look at what we can be doing even during the winter months here in Western North Carolina and in various climates. Of course, you can always adapt, and by utilizing season extension methods, you can make a hoop house, even a greenhouse, or just use your tunnels and covers and really extend your season and grow all kinds of greens. So doing that now, very happy to see some beautiful lettuces out there. We've had lots of rain, though, already soaked ground, and a lot of rain expected this winter as we are now getting records broken with the strongest El Nino effect in history expected this year. And of course, just as we kick off the climate talk in Paris yesterday, and that'll be happening for 2 weeks. Meanwhile, records keep getting shattered regarding weather, and not always just natural weather, right? The human effects are pronounced, even down to the details of engineering the weather at this point, which is, you know, gets pretty dicey when you look at what we're spewing out there. But we're basically looking at needing to be a zero carbon emission society, a sustainable culture, to be able to utilize our ability to sustain life on Earth together in the next 30, 35 years. And that's really what is necessary. And it is quite interesting to look at what is necessary and then what is happening and how different industries stand in the way, actually, of life on Earth. You know, life is good, and we've got to be building life and restoring life and doing restorative agriculture and regenerative ranching and stopping deforestation. We're talking about non-binding agreements happening, and we've never had them really be complied with before in a meaningful way that was significant enough for what is needed now. So what makes us think it's going to happen now? Well, it won't. So we've got to get some real commitments and definitely change some of the plans. There's like plans to log 30 million hectares more of forest, like we have an extra forest somehow we're going to just transplant back in. It doesn't work that way, right? Once we release carbon and we keep destroying things, it just makes things exponentially worse. So it's really important that we just stop the ecocidal industrial models and quit cashing in on our big forests. These are the lungs of the planet. We've got to quit cashing in on all of the wildlife and let it heal a bit, right? Start stewarding more. And here's to the spirit of stewardship and right moral compass leading the talk somehow truth will prevail in this, and it always does, but yet somehow we need more commitment now. And I was happy to hear our President Obama refer to sometimes being too late. And you know, if we sit here and we let nature be destroyed wantonly more and more just for a pile of meaningless money, dirty money that just hurts everyone, well, that's a crime. That's just worse than complacent. That is just an abomination. And as one fellow who's there at the climate talk said, this is the defining issue of our time, whether we're going to really protect the Earth and help restore the balance of nature and sustain life, a quality of life as well. And you know, the great part, though, that I love about this conversation and about this topic around the world is that we hear so much doom and gloom, and we see so many coal-fired plants spewing all these, you know, particulates of carbon into the air. We keep mining up carbon out of the ground. We keep burning up our atmosphere. And then we've got, you know, China and other countries over there just building more coal plants just as fast as they can, dams bursting and forests being chopped for hydroelectric. And meanwhile, guess what? We can sequester all that carbon. We can clean it up. First of all, we need to stop spewing, right? But we can do it with sustainable agricultural models. We can grow more food and draw down more carbon and feed more people and have healthier lives. But the way we're doing it now, we are looking at catastrophic food growing problems with the current industrial monoculture that is heavily dependent upon chemicals that further reduce the viability of both the soil and the food produced in it. So we've got to turn the whole thing around, right? The whole thing. And it's such a bright spot on the horizon when you think about sustainable agriculture and what it really means. And growing more gardens, garden to garden to garden, stringing them together like a little string of hearts in communities that is truly abundance in action. And that's what learning is about. Learning about things, you can do it online, free at livingwebfarms.org. Learn about sustainable and organic food growing methods and innovative ways to do things that have a positive effect on our atmosphere. Not the destructive model that poisons everything in sight. No, the life-building model. And that is our challenge. That is our charge, right? To spread that excitement, to take people for walks in those beautiful gardens and inspire them to plant those seeds in their own communities, in their own yards, in their own schools, and then remove the bureaucracy to let children be eating those foods out of the gardens and be able to have that in their cafeteria and be part of growing awesome, healthy food. It's part of the life cycle, is to be able to grow and prepare food and share it. And so great, great things happening out there, and of course a lot of needed action that isn't quite happening yet, but our thoughts are with the folks out in Paris and the climate talks happening now for the next 2 weeks, approximately 2 weeks, just started yesterday, and really great to be checking out the coverage there with Amy Goodman and Democracy Now! Yes, check it out, democracynow.org, if you want the super coverage of this conference, the really heart-touching, meaningful stuff. Check it out, democracynow.org. She's there. She's live all for the whole time, and she's bringing us great information. So I definitely recommend checking out Amy Goodman there at democracynow.org. And of course, that is a nonprofit news organization that accepts contributions. So help her go around the world and cover these great events as well. Again, democracynow.org. Well, Lisa Almaraz here, Earth Heart Network News. We are the Land to Mouth Food, Farm, and Garden Edition that comes your way every Tuesday. And, you know, there's so much going on out there, and we've changed things dynamically, dramatically, sometimes just really oftentimes destructively, right? We've got all kinds of models of failed civilizations that have not worked in sustainable models with the Earth. And meanwhile, we always have better options, right? We've got innovative methods right there at our fingertips. We've got the ability to thrive and do wonderfully together, to innovate together, to be working on this team excitedly, because we've changed the atmosphere so much. We've actually killed off so much of nature that we are missing something you might not think we'd be missing. Well, it is not enough poop. It's mega poop. Okay, this is kind of funny sounding, but livescience.com, yes, thank you. That's no crap, missing the mega poop. Yes, I'm hitting the puns here. This is the name of the article. No crap, missing mega poop starves Earth. This is by Stephanie Pappas, the Live Science contributor there at Live Science. And it's quite amazing that when you look at the problem here going on is we don't have enough of the manures being produced by wildlife anymore. We have great extinctions of megafauna, both at land and sea, that have led to a shortage of mega manure. New research is finding we are missing mega amounts of manure. The planet's composting and nutrient recycling system is broken. Yes, of course, we've jumped in the middle and affected it once more, but this broken global cycle may weaken ecosystem health, fisheries, and agriculture. This is from study researcher Joe Roman, a biologist at the University of Vermont. He's talking about the world's most endangered places. Basically, whales and other deep-diving marine mammals feed deep in the ocean, and they poop up high-moving nutrients toward the surface through the water columns. Seabirds and spawning fish transfer nutrients from sea to shore. Megafauna, such as moose, move nutrients as they graze, as well as bison and the great animals that we have, you know, exterminated from the plains of America. So we're missing so many animals. And, you know, the animals represent this loss of megafauna that once contributed to an awesome nutrient cycle. And so we've got this amazing missing manure issue. Interesting and unappetizing as it may seem, manure is the effective way to spread nutrients around the world. Now, extinct animals such as mammoths, mastodons, giant sloths were once extremely effective at fertilizing the soil. Yes, we're missing animals all over. Many, you know, human developments drive out the animals, or we just clear-cut things? Basically, as a result, natural fertilization by land animals has dropped to 8%. Just 8% of what it was at the end of the last ice age. This study team and their colleagues reported that it's even worse where nutrient transport is going on in the ocean. It's estimated at a mere 5% of historic values. People have hunted large whales down to just a tiny percent of the animal's former populations. We're looking at around 30%, and then now we've got Japan just resuming whale hunting and tons of people coming out against what is being called research, but really it's eating the whale meat. It's for sale in restaurants there. It's illegal. They're breaking the law there. But these current whale numbers are very low, and they're as low as 1% of their pre-whaling levels. There used to be so many whales in the oceans. There were old drawings that I have seen from old ship drawings on the old whaling ships where there were so many whales that they could jump from back to back. The sailors harpooning whales, they could jump from whales back to whales back. That's how many whales there was at certain points when they were together out there in the ocean. So, you know, we've got this huge loss of feces transport that spreads the nutrient phosphorus around the ocean. So declines in numbers result in a fall in nutrient transport. In particular, whales defecate their nutrient-rich waste in shallow water. This means that those nutrients aren't lost to the ocean sediment. Overall, the researchers found the ability of whales and other marine mammals to transport phosphorus is down 77% from before the days of widespread hunting. And, you know, it's so amazing because we realize how great manure is in the garden, right? We realize that and we see just fantastic-looking vegetables and just wonderful results. And yet, you know, we've kind of overlooked the need for the manure all over in nature to keep those nutrient cycles moving from sea to land. It moves around via these animals, and that has been a huge loss out there as we have developed much of these natural areas and continue to destroy more. We've got such amazing cycles that we have interrupted on so many levels. Both the collapse of fisheries and the fall in seabird numbers have endangered the sea-to-land pipeline. Phosphorus movement via both bird manure and dead fish is down an estimated 96%. So we've really got the whole cycles of nature are being halted, derailed, interrupted, misaligned as we change things out there. The researchers made estimates using mathematical models based on historical estimates along with current species populations and ranges from the International Union for Conservation of Nature. However, the scientists could not prove that the missing manure has led to declines in fertility of the land. They have not pulled that data together to determine that, and they don't know how to do that. I mean, they're saying the data to determine that doesn't exist, but if you pull some data points together, the data is certainly out there to be pulling together. The findings do suggest that a decline in fertility in many regions is likely due to this broken nutrient cycle. So, you know, even more, we find out day to day how animals have played this important role in nutrient movement. Previously, animals were not thought to play this important role, and they've learned different now. Christopher Dowdy, an ecologist at the University of Oxford in the United Kingdom, said in the statement that this misunderstanding may have arisen for a good reason. By the time humans started studying nutrient transport, most of the large important mammals that played this role were gone. So our study, once again, we are behind nature cycles, and we're behind in knowing what's really been going on because we just started studying it after many of them were gone. You know, so we're a little bit late to the game here, and that's why we can't always wait for, you know, 100 different angles for science to prove every single thing, because we can see the results. As long as we're seeing the good results and then we can keep testing, keep learning, great. But we've got to move ahead in the direction of innovation, of intelligence, true intelligence that is guided and mentored by nature to us so we can learn along the way and discover more and more just how multidimensional our world is and our place in it. So animals, a critical, critical piece in nutrient exchange and building nutrients in the soil, in the sea, in our food. So this was once a world that had 10 times more whales, 20 times more anadromous fish like salmon, double the number of seabirds, and 10 times more large herbivores, giant sloths, mastodons, mammoths. Domesticated animals like cattle are too fenced in and concentrated to play this role, the researchers found. But when we're looking at maybe moving the grazing patterns and building fertility in different ways and spreading things around and using those high-density models that are in rotational patterns, we can start to mimic nature. Utilizing biomimicry, we can start to restore and make this restorative model be sequestering the carbon and changing the conversation on climate and stabilizing the climate. So great to see that it's even more important to have conservation measures put in place to restore this odoriferous transport system. It's big bison herds being reestablished on the Great Plains, for example, marine protections for large ocean goers. We need to create a world with abundant populations of whales again, of the great creatures not having the record deaths that have been going on. We've had 100% mortality rate in the orca whales recently. There's some horrendous things going on out there. And meanwhile, you know, we're losing sight of some of the important things we can be doing. So it's great to be able to stop. And even though we get distracted, it's great to be able to turn and just realize conservation is the number one thing. And stopping spewing so much of the poisons out there and just really, really banning those things. We realize it's destructive to our soil, to our food, to everyone. And it makes people sick, right? Why do we want to eat food that makes us sick? We don't. So let's grow more organic food and let's quit spewing those poisons. And hats off. Thank you, EPA, for revoking. Yes, brand new breaking news here from the New York Times Business Day section. Andrew Pollack bringing us this story. EPA revokes. Yes, thank you. Revokes approval of a new Dow herbicide for GMO crops. The EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, in a surprising move of some great sense here, I'm so glad to see this, has decided to revoke the approval of herbicide that was made to be used on a new generation of genetically modified crops. Meanwhile, we've got the GMO labs being shut down around the world. We've got people rejecting GMOs all over Europe. We've got an outright ban on GMOs in Russia. We've got tons of countries now, almost 40-something countries, banning GMOs, banning glyphosate, banning Roundup. Meanwhile, it continues to proliferate. This chemical pestilence really continues to proliferate here in America. But great move as the EPA does revoke this new herbicide. The agency's decision could delay the introduction of corn, soybeans, and cotton developed by Dow Chemical to be resistant to the herbicide 2,4-D. But Dow said it did not anticipate significant delay. But meanwhile, the court filings are going on, and there's a lot of different things happening regarding weed science. This new Enlist Duo contains a new formulation of 2,4-D, it containing, yes, glyphosate once again, even though we know that it's a carcinogenic thing, carcinogenic compound that has been hidden from us knowing it, even though the company has known for a long time. So meanwhile, they are continuing to prepare for sales, but they have had their approval revoked. And it is a setback for the second recent one for Dow AgroSciences and the EPA. The Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit vacated in September the EPA's approval of a Dow pesticide called sulfoxaflor. There we go. Sulfoxaflor. I tell you, these are real tongue twisters, aren't they? After beekeepers and others said the agency had not adequately studied the risk of the chemical to bees. So, you know, we've got to take up for our pollinators, right? That's our food supply. That's our biodiversity. And it's very important that we do that. Great to be with you this afternoon, Earth Heart Network Radio. And, you know, very rare that we get to tie in food with something interesting like this story here. Restoring Liberty is a great little website here with Joe Miller and joemiller.us. Yes, he's talking about Ben & Jerry's. This is a sweet story, very sweet story. Ben & Jerry's has just announced 7 new Bernie Sanders-themed ice cream flavors. Can you believe that? How often can we associate restoring liberty with ice cream, right? And Bernie Sanders. I have to say, I'm very proud of him. He's such a tiger. He's out there. He's giving voice to so much truth that hasn't been spoken about. He's really got the lead in so many polls. It's amazing to watch Bernie go, okay? And I'm just so happy to see Ben & Jerry's Ice Cream proud to announce an exciting new partnership with Bernie Sanders. Yes, it's Vermont. They love Vermont. Bernie's from Vermont. They couldn't be more proud of him there. So what have we got? We've got some triple tax coffee. Yes, this sweet blend of all-natural vanilla ice cream is combined with a triple helping of toffee and triple scoop of tax applied to the price. Triple tax coffee. Every purchase will help to disempower a low-risk individual through the reallocation of wealth and increasing resources to reap available to trap them in a vicious cycle of welfare dependency and entitlements. It's really interesting how they're pulling together all of the political jargon here. They've got We the People Werther's. This is another flavor. Occupy your arteries. Oh, boy. This is going to be quite interesting. We've got double fudge ice cream, chunks of bacon, and ribbons of sour cream and mayonnaise. Then we've got social just ice, burnt ends, carbon neutral nut, socialist swirl. And it's going to be interesting. You can sit there and read more about these at your local grocery stores coming up. So one way to support the Bernie Sanders campaign. Thank you, Ben & Jerry's, for jumping up on that. Well, you know, sometimes you've just got some extra greens. You've got some extra things you want to share with your community. We're always about making you more aware of your local farmers markets, encouraging you to grow your own garden and share that. And here's a great way to do it. Now, I was so happy to meet the founder of FarmZ at the Carolina Farm Stewardship Association Sustainable Agriculture Conference, and I wanted to tell you about FarmZ.com. FarmZ connects you to local farmers. And if you're a farmer, you can get on there. You can sell products online. You can accept credit cards, inventory control, and reports all built in. You've got a customer database, and it's free. Isn't that cool, FarmZ? Look up the app in your Play Store. Then for people who want to eat that great food, they say farmers, consumers, wish we could come up with a better name than consumers. How about, you know, fresh food eaters or something? But also register free, support local farmers, browse farms and products, order directly from farms, pre-order and schedule deliveries from farms. So FarmZ.com, FarmZie. Yeah, FarmZ. Get all FarmZy, you know, even if you have a farm or you want to eat from a farm, just get all FarmZy. Get on there and find out who your farmer is and go bring them a surprise, you know, when you first go over there to the farm or share something fun and get to know those farmers. FarmZy.com. So big congratulations for them getting that off the ground and looking at it being a very successful way to connect farmers and people in communities all over the place. So great to see. Well, we've got things happening out there. You know, we've got food deserts. We've got all kinds of people with massive health problems in America from the standard American diet. Yes, the SAD, the sad diet. Even been found to cause depression, obesity, all kinds of problems, right? It's not food. It's those fake food products that are toxic. Well, guess what? Some communities are taking their food back, and they are transforming those food deserts. And one place that is happening is in Atlanta, Georgia. This from the Atlanta Black Star. So surprised to see a wonderful story posted by Tamia King. Black community is coming together to turn the food desert there into a $2 million co-op. Congratulations over there in Atlanta. For almost two decades, residents who live in a predominantly African-American Greensboro neighborhood didn't have a place to shop for food. The community tried to attract the attention of a popular grocery store, but it didn't work. They decided, you know what, we're going to open our own store. Last year, New Economy Week reported on this Greensboro community and the people's plan to create their own grocery store. And they did it. They made their own grocery store supply. The publication reached out to the neighborhood to see how their plans were coming along. Guilford County in North Carolina currently has 24 food deserts. Food deserts are defined as neighborhoods that are considered high poverty, where at least a third of the residents live a mile or greater from the nearest grocery store. 17 of these 24 food deserts are in Greensboro. The 2014 report from the Committee on Food Desert Zones in North Carolina states that people who live in these food deserts are more likely to have diseases such as diabetes, obesity, and cardiovascular diseases, along with other health conditions. The report also states the consequences of food deserts could be enormous for public health, the economy, national security, and more. Right? If people are poor, they don't have much money, they might not have a car, and they can't get to a grocery store where there's good enough food to eat to sustain themselves, and they eat whatever they can get to nearby, maybe fast food, maybe at a 7-Eleven, maybe some little junky convenience store, right? And that's what they're eating out of. I'd be sick inside of a week if I ate like that. I mean, I know I would feel horrible eating like that. I can't imagine people that are just used to eating that way, and they don't even know how much better they could feel, right? And yet they're starting to have the crescendo of health problems that come from eating products like that. Won't even call it food, right? Products packed with all kinds of synthetic chemicals and things and preservatives and stuff that we know cause cancer. Big new reports about just how carcinogenic the processed meats are. So big changes in filling in those gaps, planting more gardens, working at having a co-op, bringing together stores where there are not stores. So they are pulling their community together. They're investing. They started selling memberships to raise money. Community members could pay $100 to become member owners, and this gave them voting privileges. They're getting their voting together. They're making their own co-op, and they are bringing together community health and harmony. This dream of a co-op happening in Northeast Greensboro is also becoming a reality. They're hoping their hard work is going to show others what business looks like when the goal is helping the community thrive. And healthy food is what you do to help a community thrive. You get those good gardens out there, the fresh vegetables and the things that make you feel better, those alkalizing foods. And next thing you know, everyone is participating. Everyone is getting along better, feeling better, and really a fantastic opportunity. Also providing jobs. One of the co-ops is going to have 15 permanent and 17 part-time jobs. They're going to be above minimum wage jobs. And they're also going to have access to this great food, which is going to improve their whole quality of life. So great to see. Congratulations there, Atlanta, and also Greensboro. Fantastic progress. When a community fills in the desert of lack of healthy food with a real effort from the heart, and that feeds the community in a whole other way, right? It feeds the soul of the community. So wonderful to see people coming together out there, working on things regarding the climate, working on raising awareness. This week, thousands and thousands of people are gathering in Paris for the United Nations Climate Conference. Now, we do know that public protests have been banned, but people are still putting out thousands of pairs of shoes to say, hey, we are here, we care. People are putting out information in other ways. We're looking at some kind of meaningful agreement this time. We may or may not get it, but we can still take action every day. We can still find ways to make progress in our own communities, in our own home, for the health of the earth and all generations, present and future. It's paramount that we seize this moment and recognize there will be no effective action on climate change until our struggles as people and communities come together on a personal basis all the way up to that global scale. Things like women's struggles in small places like Africa, 75% of farmers are women, raising the children, feeding the villages. So we're moving ahead, and yet we have a long way to go, but it's time for us to recognize that, you know, we all benefit from a great binding agreement that some countries and companies can jump up and do. You know, everyone doesn't have to keep floating along the same non-committal river of destruction toward oblivion and human-made Armageddon, right? Humageddon, that's what I call that. No, we could actually, somebody can stand up and say, hey, this water isn't too deep. It's enough for us to take responsibility right now, grab each other by the hand, and get to work on this. Companies and countries and individuals can make commitments, can make their own binding commitments and agreements. We don't have to always wait. Sometimes when the people lead, the leaders will follow. So, all over the world, countries have much to gain. Australia has much to gain from a low-carbon economy and much to lose from inaction in business as usual. The coastlines are looking at some major devastation. We're talking about losses of some major world cities. On mainstream media, we're just not getting the coverage for Paris, but there's great stories happening, fantastic things, people raising awareness about fracking, people raising awareness about preserving the forest, about restoring the natural ecosystems that are left out there, stopping all the cashing in. We've got to have a new mindset, and we've got to have a new heart set, a new place we're coming from in our hearts that is deeply aware and humbled by where we are right now. And you get comments from astute gentlemen like the 14th Dalai Lama of Tibet. You know, he's so wise, he always garners quite a lot of attention for very good reasons. And most recently, he made a comment about the mass brainwashing of society. And you know, the picture when he's talking, I'm reading the story, he's touching the top of his head like, people got to realize what's going on. People have to be aware beyond what they hear and really look at the truth of situation. Recently, he told the world that simply praying is not the answer for the incident that not only occurred in Paris, but also for the upcoming meetings. These atrocities are happening all over the globe. He says, humans have created this problem, and we can't ask someone else to solve it. We created this mess. We should be the ones to solve it. His comments went viral. He said, not God. It's us that needs to do this, not God. Well, we can certainly be inspired by the spirit of love and of sharing and of responsibility. But his comments went viral, resonating with many people around the world who realize action on a mass scale is required at this time to change the direction in which our planet seems to be headed. It's not our planet, it's us. We're the ones steering this every choice, every day. But of course, the big, large organizations need to be going in the right direction as well, right? We've got to be working together. Intertwined with the recent Paris attacks of a few weeks ago, the realities of war, and many other things. A great piece is written on the Dalai Lama's website regarding mass brainwashing of human beings. And, you know, he talks about suffering and what we've done out there, what we're doing by promoting suffering and what we can do differently. Talking about modern warfare, talking about the destruction of nature. So we've got to change everything we're doing for the better. And we know what to do. Thanks for the Dalai Lama for getting up and saying we should feel fed up with the violence and killing going on around us. If a human being is killed by an animal, it's sad. But if a human being is killed by another human being, it's unthinkable. We have to make a special effort to think of each other as fellow human beings, as our brothers and sisters. And I feel the same about that with our family of friends in the forests, our beautiful orangutans, our monkeys, our everything, all the creatures out there that are part of the biodiverse world that we live in. Protecting it, loving it, honoring it, being part of it, feeling the connection, and being restored by it. Nature does restore us. And as we restore nature, it builds the soul back into our communities. And in places like China, there are women out there that are leading an organic farming work force team. They're calling it a new organic farming army. But, you know, I like to think in peaceful terms and, you know, stewards, new organic farming stewards in Legion are coming together. This one woman, Shi Yan, her approach to organic farming is helping to break the country's use of pesticides. She is being a great example. She's being a trailblazer in agriculture. She's 33 years old. Yan is a trailblazer in Chinese ag as a young student at Beijing's Renmin University. She was concerned about the widespread environmental damage, such as soil erosion, being caused by chemical-reliant farming practices. She wants to do it differently. She's doing it. She's bringing together community-focused gardens. CSA farms are being run. There's all kinds of things going on. She's been looking for real solutions to the problem of pesticide-laden food. She said, it changed my life. It wasn't only a workable business model, it's a lifestyle. And so she is out there being a wonderful example for others, not only other women farmers, but the organic methods that she's using. Now, she's got Shared Harvest. It's a result of what Jan learned during her six-month stint at the American Farm, where she came to learn. It covered everything from farming methods to member management. And the farm is not only her workplace, it's also the place where she held her wedding. At Shared Harvest, she's got all kinds of things growing there and also fed her guests with that. Her farm supplies fresh produce to 500 members living in the city. She's got 500 member CSA. She says a lot of people don't know where their food comes from. It's a world far away. But CSA is about relationships. It's important for consumers to understand and build a relationship with farmers, says Jan. Isn't that great? Just like we were talking about on Farmsy, getting in touch with your farmer, knowing your farmer, having your produce, becoming a farmer and sharing it. When she first started Shared Harvest, few had even heard of a CSA there in China where she is. Now there are more than 500 CSA farms in China. This month, Jan helped organize the 6th annual international and 7th national CSA conferences, which took place in Beijing. So now they not only have CSAs going on, they have conferences for CSAs to come together to get inspired, to get more organized, to get ideas, to make friends. Healthy methods breeding healthy relationships. Her farm prides itself on all natural alternatives to synthetic pesticides. Instead of anything synthetic and or fertilizing or herbicides, she's using natural things, natural sprays, natural disease control, organic methods. Farmers can spend a lot of time picking bugs or doing these things on a larger scale. So they have to be careful and really work on keeping that balance that we always talk about with biodiversity. And basically, she talks about the key is managing her soil quality. She says, take humans, for example. If you're healthy when you get a cold, you're able to recover naturally and faster. With farms, the most important thing is soil. If the soil is carefully maintained, then the diversity and quality of the produce is also good, and you can deal with the problems better. So wonderful to see more eco-friendly and organic methods spreading in India, more methods being utilized in Russia. Many new organic farmers are starting out in that country. Sometimes finding natural solutions can be a little tedious, and you have to do a little research. I encourage you to look things up. We have some organic disease control strategies there, a whole video on that at livingwebfarms.org. Look it up and find out more. Really, biodiversity is a big key to all of the natural disease control and pesticide self-managed with their own little communities there. The more diverse the insect populations are, the more they manage themselves. And nature works, right? Nature doesn't need inputs. Nature works in relationship. So even though pesticides were first introduced in the 70s in China, it became a mainstay over there. Now they've really paid the price. They've got toxic soils. They've lost very much of their ability to grow food. Some of those soils are so toxic now, and they're working on trying to remediate. They need to use more bioremediation there. The agricultural industry gorged itself on chemical use in order to increase and maintain food output to sustain their growing population. However, the environment and ultimately the consumers have paid the price. It has been high. That unsustainable model of mining the soil has been very high. And the food isn't even good, right? The food isn't even good at that point. It's bad for us at that point. So they ended up with a famine during the Cultural Revolution. They were terrified of being hungry at one point. And so now the situation is changing. They're witnessing 11 consecutive years of grain increase. Now the concern is environmental damage and food safety. So this year, China was ranked as one of the world's worst safety violation offenders by the American food consulting firm Food Sentry, which noted that pesticides were a major problem. Laboratory testing found that 32 distinct pesticides were found in Chinese foods, mostly produce, fruit, and spices. A variety of studies have found a link between pesticides and, of course, a wide range of health problems. American research released in 2009 also shows strong links between agrochemicals and birth defects. So, you know, we've recently had country of origin labels being removed from meats. So be careful when it comes to seafood, especially shrimp and other fish, salmon, tilapia, things like that, that are being grown over in Indonesia, especially shrimp and other seafood. We've got horrendous filthy situation going on with how they're growing that shrimp. I gave you the description here on the show a couple of weeks ago. Pretty dramatic. I don't think I could even come up with a more gross description of anything. Put it that way. So be careful what you're eating out there. We're losing labels here, but wonderful to see that there are folks doing new things, blazing new trails, and building trust and building more farms that are organic over there in China. Beijing Farmers Market is happening every week. They've got 1,000 customers every weekend happening there. A permanent community market shop is close by. Customers are falling into two groups, mainly elderly Chinese and families with young children. But they are over there at the farmers market. They are shopping it up with the farmers and even visiting farms, building trust, and growing a grassroots social enterprise that helps local farmers. So fantastic to see that progress happening in China. Well, great to be with you this afternoon, Lisa Almaraz, as we sit here in this cloudy, rainy fall afternoon. Got some organic split peas cooking on the oven with those organic carrots and garlic in there, a little bit of celery and delicious smoked paprika, and making a delicious, tummy-warming afternoon meal, you know, with some nice jasmine rice and fresh grass-fed butter, golden-y butter on top with a little minced raw garlic on the rice. I love that. So time to get the cozy food out. Hope you had a wonderful Thanksgiving. I hope you've been pile-driving through that giant mound of leftovers. Well, that's how it is around here anyway. I tend to make a huge, huge Thanksgiving thing, and there's usually plenty of leftover for a while, but we have been managing to eliminate quite a lot of those. I get sort of tired of eating turkey after Thanksgiving, so after I let folks have their way with the leftovers, I take what is left, make a bone broth, right, with the bones from the turkey, and let that really simmer for a full day, 24 hours or so, and then get that wonderful broth and make a turkey stew with French lentils and some of the chopped turnips and rutabagas and some of the other green beans from the meal, and just make this delicious turkey stew that I freeze, because I get where I just can't eat that much turkey the week after Thanksgiving. So I freeze that very, very hearty and warming turkey stew and then can pull out a jar all winter long. Got about 11 jars yesterday put up for that, so we can prolong the turkey pleasure without overdosing on it immediately, right? That tryptophan, boy, I got all sleepy on Thursday. It was just like, boom. Felt like somebody hit me with a sleepy pillow in the head. Just, phew. Great food, though. Very comforting. And hope you have enjoyed a wonderful holiday with your family as we move toward winter solstice and then, of course, Christmas and New Year's. We've got a big, big, happy holiday season coming up. So best to you and your family. Hope you plan some memory-making events, something that is maybe a new tradition, right? A new tradition in your family that brings together appreciating local food. Maybe go meet a local farm that allows pickup of things in the winter time, and say meet one new local farmer each winter. Something interesting. Maybe get together a little seed kit that you can give to someone to help them keep some greens growing through winter. Maybe someone who's on the edge food security wise. There's lots of ways to give and share an appreciation of food so that we make the holiday more sacred. And we do it by really extending that spirit of love. So I encourage you to think of something extra neato, extra special this year regarding food and farming and organic eating somehow. Just come up with some creative way to integrate that into your holiday. Well, as I was mentioning whales a moment ago, here's some interesting news I thought I would share. Some of us are allies of nature, and some of us are waiting in the wings. Some of us are being distracted by meaningless media and drivel on screens and video games and a bunch of other things that just keep us from focusing on what's important if we so choose to allow those to attract our attention. But then there are those who are really doing something. And not to say an opinion on what people do necessarily, whether it's right or wrong, but you know, some people are out there really going for it. And I was kind of amazed because we've had some horrible things happening to whales, as I mentioned earlier, where we've got Japanese boats hunting them, we've got radiation poisoning them, we've got all kinds of mortality going on, we have naval seismic tests going on, were they living under there in the Gulf of Alaska and the Chukchi Sea. We've got so much threats going on to these beautiful, amazing, important creatures. And I just think, what can we do? You know, and I always loved Jacques Cousteau, and I follow the sea shepherd, Paul Watson. He's a real hero out there trying to save the cetaceans and help stand up for the whales. But I was pretty amazed this week to find out just there after Thanksgiving on Friday, Anonymous, yes, the famous hacker collective Anonymous, took down 5 government websites in Iceland to protest whale hunting. Online activists associated with Anonymous took down 5 websites belonging to the Icelandic government and 2 other related sites as part of their campaign to protest against any type of regulated whale hunting. According to a local Icelandic website, grapevine.is, the attack took place late Friday, November 27th, and lasted 13 hours until midday Saturday when the sites returned online. They don't want to have regulated whale hunting. Whales are endangered. As we've mentioned, whales are down to just 1% of former levels from times before, and we've got to restore them. We've got dangers coming their way from all directions. We've got to preserve and protect them. And it's so interesting to see these hacktivists announcing in advance that they were going to have these attacks going on. They uploaded a video on YouTube 2 days prior. And they went up there. 5 targeted websites belonging to the Ministry of the Environment and Natural Resources, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, Ministry of the Interior, Iceland's Prime Minister, and the government's main portal. Additionally, the site belonging to H.B. Grandi, an Icelandic whale fishing company, was also hit, along with the website of the Japanese Whaling Association. Pretty interesting. You can check tweets for the exact URLs of those, but basically, that's their way of standing up for the whales. And anonymous hackers are also have set up a special Twitter account and website. And there's a warning, animal cruelty images are on this link. They do not support animal cruelty, and they're doing something about it. Yes, their most recent hashtag #OpWhales campaign, they also uploaded to Ghostbin a list of websites they plan to target in the future. As they say, expect us. So they are going for it, and they're going to be taking action for the whales. I am amazed. I'm amazed. You know, I don't know what it takes sometimes for us to change in this world. You know, we're sitting here on the brink of the biggest challenge we've ever had with the climate, and everybody's in Paris, and they still don't have binding agreements planned. You know, what is it going to take for us, right? It takes us to muster the will, the deep commitment to do things differently, to stop hunting the whales, to let nature restore itself. Pretty amazing. Thanks to news.softpedia.com there for that story. I was kind of just flabbergasted to read that. I was amazed, you know, helping the whales. The whales need us, need our help. You know, sometimes we do it in our own way. I don't necessarily approve of taking down government websites, but I horrendously do not approve of the mass slaughter of the whales. And I'm kind of impressed that Anonymous is using their skills to help the most amazing creatures. I love them. They're all amazing, right? But the whales really need help. And they shouldn't be being hunted. They need to be protected. So I'm glad somebody is trying. And let us all try a little more. Let's all do it, okay? Instead of sitting back, distracting ourselves with the abundant amount of baloney multimedia that's out there, and forget about what our skies should look like, and forget about things that really matter to us. Right? And when you start reading the agronomic library and you start learning about the effects of things we're spewing out there, like aluminum and heavy metals, and then you look at, wow, direct toxicity primarily as stunted roots. We need our roots. The roots hold the soil together. And the nutrient cycle can complete itself. We've already did the story on the mega manure missing formula. And, you know, we've got to really be making the most of our toxicity. Make the most of it. Change the most dramatically we can. Lift our voices as we can. Use our influence where we can every single day, starting right now. And lately, I've been thanking some of the prominent people who are utilizing their fame and influence and money and whatever they can parlance for the planet. And thanks to Classic Rock, yes, classicrock.com, for this story on dozens of artists, including people like Robert Plant, formerly of Led Zeppelin, yes, and the Honey Drippers, Robert Plant, and dozens of artists are signing an open letter asking for a stronger environmental framework for the Paris conference. David Bowie, Robert Plant, David Gilmour, Ian Anderson, they're among dozens of names of famous folks who have signed a petition calling for an ambitious and inspiring international agreement on tackling climate change. The open letter, set up by nonprofit organization Julie's Bicycle, has been sent to leaders of the upcoming Paris Climate Conference. This is running until December 11th. The letter reads, "We are deeply concerned that our global economic and industrial systems are accelerating rates of extinction, desertification, and soil depletion, degrading ecosystems, acidifying and littering our rivers and oceans, and resulting in a relentless rise in greenhouse gas emissions, driving irreversible climate change. In short, we are overwhelming the planet's life support systems. The next months will determine many of the long-term conditions that will affect us today and for many generations to come. The artists want to see a limit of greenhouse gas emissions below 2 degrees and ask for a comprehensive binding international framework agreement on greenhouse gas emissions reductions." Other names from the music world who have added their signature include Tom York, Phil Selway, Guy Carvey, Carl Palmer, and Henry Rollins. Authors, actors, and other representatives from the creative industry have also contributed to the petition. So, this is happening. York, along with Patti Smith and Red Hot Chili Peppers bassist Flea, will take part in the Pathway to Paris concert on December 4th. And, you know, everybody has a stake in this, everyone. So, you know, sad to see we still are lacking the binding agreements, but great to know that we have people that care, people that are stepping up, people that are talking about it, people that are working on it, because we love nature, we love our planet, we love the biodiversity, and we want to live here peacefully and sustainably. And sometimes we're a little too blinded by what we can do. And just because we can do something doesn't mean we really should. But sometimes when we can do something, maybe we ought to do it more often. And maybe we didn't even know why it felt so great. And this, a wonderful little story validating tree hugging. Yes, tree hugging, now scientifically validated, absolutely wonderful effects on the body. Yes, from the UnboundedSpirit.com. It has recently been scientifically validated that hugging trees is excellent for you. Research has shown you don't even have to touch the tree to get better. Just being within its vicinity has beneficial effects. In a recently published book, Blinded by Science, author Matthew Silverstone proves scientifically that trees do in fact improve many health issues such as concentration levels, reaction times, depression, stress, and other various forms of mental illness. He even points to research indicating a tree's ability to alleviate headaches in humans seeking relief by communing with trees. A number of studies have shown that children have significant psychological and physiological improvement in terms of their health and well-being when they interact with plants and trees. Specifically, research indicates children function better cognitively and emotionally in green environments and have more creative play in green areas. Also, he quotes a major public health report that investigated the association between green spaces and mental health, concluded that access to nature can significantly contribute to our mental capital and well-being. So there are many great things you can see. You can actually measure human electromagnetic field while sitting under a tree. We absorb some of the tree's energy through our microcosmic orbit and in various points on our body that relate to the ancient Chinese arts of healing. You can find the relationship of your body's electromagnetic field and the trees in interaction. They affect us physiologically very positively and in a very subtle manner. One research experiment showed if you drink a glass of water that has been treated with a 10 hertz vibration, your blood coagulation rates will change immediately on ingesting the treated water. It is the same with trees. When touching a tree, its different vibrational pattern will affect various biological behaviors in our body. This vibrational idea is backed up throughout the book by a number of scientific studies to provide convincing proof that tree hugging has incredible benefits to us. One report even concluded the following: safe green spaces may be effective in treating forms of mental illness. So really, connecting with nature is absolutely healing. Another school of thought aligns with the remarkable theory in Taoism. For example, the Taoist master Mantak Chia teaches students to meditate with trees as a way of releasing negative energy. In his Cosmic Tree Healing Qigong method, Master Chia teaches how to align one's body with the aura or energetic field of a tree, explaining trees are natural processors that help us transform our body's sick or negative energy into positive, vital life force. As you connect with the tree, we facilitate our own physical and emotional healing. So their view of trees is to see them constantly in meditation with subtle energy as their natural language. And so it has been proven, and it is wonderful, and we have all these wonderful benefits. And you can even see singing plants out there. Plants and us, well, we have a great thing. So I encourage you to get out there and be part of nature. If you feel a little out of it, a little wonky, get over there, get out in a peaceful place in nature, and you will feel wonderful. You'll start to feel tiny again and in the arms of majesty and beauty. Because, you know, long before we were here, this world was a wondrous place. And just to get a little glimpse back in time, thank you to Colin Schultz from Smithsonian Magazine on this one, smithsonianmag.com. Long before trees overtook the land, even before trees, the earth was covered by giant mushrooms from around 420 to 350 million years ago, when land plants were still the relatively new kids on the evolutionary block. The tallest trees stood just a few feet high. While this was going on, giant spires of life poked from the earth. The ancient organism boasted trunks of up to 24 feet high and as wide as 3 feet. This is from National Geographic talking about the ancient fungus. With the help of a fossil dig in Saudi Arabia, scientists finally figured out what the giant creature was. Oh, these are giant mushrooms. The towering fungus spires would have stood out against a landscape scarce of such things. And they're talking about a 6-meter fungus would be very odd in today's world, about an 18 to 20 foot mushroom. But trees were much smaller back then, and the organisms known as prototaxites had peppered the paleontological findings of the past half century, ever since they were first discovered by a Canadian in 1859. But despite the fossil records, no one could figure out what the heck these things were. No one knew. So for the next 130 years, debate raged. Some scientists called prototaxites a lichen, others a fungus, and still others clung to the notion it was some kind of tree. But we're finding out it was a fungus, a giant early mushroom. And so now we realize the relationship of mycelium in soil and even their relationship to trees. But they were there even before the trees. And so think about that the next time you have a little mushroom on your plate, and think about cultivating more biodiversity in your diet, in your community, in your daily activities. And we'll talk to you next week right here on Earth Heart Network Radio.